A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to the latest edition of the Football Writers Podcast, featuring me, Mike Calvin, Miguel Delaney of The Independent, and Daniel Storey of the I newspaper. Manchester United have now gone 4 seasons without a trophy. Their inert performance in the Europa League final has raised fundamental questions that we'll attempt to answer later on. But first, another indication of how high the stakes are on football's biggest occasions. As ridiculous as it sounds, a Chelsea win in Porto on Saturday evening would sweep away the first whispered doubts about Thomas Tuchel. For Pep Guardiola, the Champions League final is much more clear-cut. Victory would be a signature achievement. Miggs, would it also confirm his legacy as one of the great coaches?
I'd say it would probably just give us the record that appropriately crowns it, because I don't think there's any doubt really at this point that Guardiola is one of the best managers to ever been involved in football. He's probably one of the most influential up there with Arrigo Sacchi, Reus Michels, Helenio Herrera, in that what he's done has had a profound influence on how football is played. And of course, Johan Cruyff as well, I should say. But I mean, even as you can see from Cruyff's career, there's sometimes an odd thing between influences and truly successful managers, and that the influential managers almost kind of, they do one thing then blaze out after a while. It's almost like they have that one revolution. So Cruyff only won that one European Cup and actually managed 7 years. There's almost been similar with Sacchi, actually, who, as brilliant as that AC Milan team were, they actually only won one league title and 2 European Cups, which, I mean, and the one league title almost feels almost underperformance given the historic status of that side. Whereas, obviously now, with Pep Guardiola, we could have both the influence, but also this astounding success. I mean, he's already one of the most successful managers of all time in terms of league titles, with 9. And it does feel like that 3 European Cups matching that Bob Paisley, Zinedine Zidane, and now Carlo Ancelotti record would really confirm that and put out, and just almost lead to the completeness to his record. Although I must say, it does feel surprising that it's now been 10 years since his last European Cup. I think I was in Wembley on the event of his last one. I think anyone who watched him Barcelona that day, in fact, anyone who watched him anywhere, would have thought he would have maybe claimed a third and maybe a fourth before then. So, I mean, it's almost become that kind of holy grail quality for him as well.
Yeah, it certainly has. I suppose, you know, one of the things which has defined this season is the way that you can almost visibly see Pep's influence in the evolution of this current team. On that, Dan, how good do you think this City team is, say, compared to his others at Barca and even Bayern?
I think this is probably a little bit different because it feels like the first time that Guardiola really came under serious pressure, having already gained the success that he wanted. So, you know, he came under pressure in his first season in England. There was talk about whether he could kind of thrive in the Premier League, and he made those doubters look pretty silly pretty quickly with the 2 league titles. At the start of this season, I think there probably were whispers, or maybe even louder than that, about whether he could create a second great team at Manchester City. And he seems to have done that very much on the job. And winning the Champions League would clearly be the crowning glory of that. And he would argue, I think, that they have been the best team in Europe this season and therefore deserve it. He spoke this week about maybe the coin just fell on our side, which I think is probably more a reference to bad luck in previous years than good luck this year. But it does feel more than ever, you know, that if they win the Champions League final on Saturday, they'll become the first team to win 11 Champions League games in the same season. Bayern won every game last season in a kind of short knockout stage. So it would feel like a real dominant statement of not just Guardiola's brilliance and how he's changed this team, but also something he's done a little bit different in kind of building a second great team. At Barcelona, I think, you know, Lionel Messi was always a standout player. Xavi and Iniesta in midfield, Busquets. At Bayern, it didn't really happen in the Champions League. This, to me, would feel a little bit different to that.
Yeah. In specifics, Miguel, you know, there's been a new role for Gundogan. You know, we've all looked at that no-striker system. I suppose there's also been a recovery of trust in John Stones. What has been the decisive innovation, do you think, this season?
Well, I think from what I've heard from people around Manchester City, and I know we've discussed this in terms of the league title, he did basically adapt their conditioning program around autumn to ensure they wouldn't burn out, and has basically made a more restrained Manchester City where they haven't pressed in the same way, doesn't mean the same breaks. So they've been that bit more based on solidity, which is obviously where the signing of Ruben Dias is so key. And I suppose, I mean, let's not lose sight of this. It does help in a year when no one else can really spend, bar their opponents, Chelsea. You're able to sign £100 million worth of centre-backs and one of them, you don't even need him to barely play at all. But in saying that, of course, there's always two issues here with Guardiola. Yes, he's been blessed with great resources at all of the clubs he's been at, but ultimately he is one of those resources. People pay for his genius as a manager. And in that, I think he basically solved pandemic football. And in this case, that really means the intensity, huge demands of this schedule, which has been unprecedented in football history. I think that's added to City's sense of security. And let's not forget, of course, as well, in October, when you spoke to anyone around Manchester City, there was a widespread feeling that this was maybe all close to being done, that the players are actually really fatigued with Guardiola's intensity. You know, that classic thing of kind of needing change after 3 or 4 years. It has to be either the manager or the players. Now, to be fair, he has altered the spine of the team. But yeah, I think it's really a mixture of all those things and maybe just a shift towards a slightly more solid City, which has made a difference. And that's radiated in performances where previously there's been anxiety in the games. And I actually think the games against Dortmund and the halftime switch at Paris Saint-Germain are key to this. Whereas previously there's been anxiety in big Champions League games for City, here there was only assurance.
Yeah, it's interesting, you know, looking back to those Dortmund matches, Daniel, about, you know, basically Phil Foden scored the winning goals in both of both legs. That's a sign of his ability to excel in the biggest of games. Where do you rate him now in European terms or even global terms? He's 21 on Friday. Best young player in Europe?
It probably slightly depends how you define young. I think Kylian Mbappe is probably still comes under that definition and is probably a more valuable asset than him. I think in different positions you could argue, make cases for Eduardo Camavinga and Alphonso Davies and Erling Haaland, but I think he's probably the best young attacking midfielder in world football. And he's English and seems to have this ability to rise to the occasion rather than shy away from it, which, and to the kind of maturity within games to retain the ball rather than panic when he's pressured, which is distinctly un-English for those of us who have watched the national team over the last two, three, however many decades. So, yeah, I mean, you know, credit to City, credit to the academy to an extent, credit to Guardiola for how he's managed him, but all the youth coaches you speak to about Foden say that this is as a freak talent who is always destined to get to the top and had this remarkable skill and a kind of ability to use a skill in the right ways. There's no skill for its own sake here. Everything has a purpose. Everything seems to be driven behind. And in a very short space of time, he's become a leader of that team and a very Pep Guardiola-like player.
Yeah. It was interesting you mentioned conditioning earlier on, Migs. Is there a comparison to be made between Foden and Mason Mount? Foden looks fresher. Now, maybe that's because his workload has been better managed. Mount, to me, has been symptomatic of Chelsea's, you know, recent last two or three games where he has seemed – almost done, exhausted. You know, we saw last night in the Europa League final, people like Bruno Fernandes looking burnt out. Is there a comparison to be made between the two?
Yeah, possibly, yes. And I mean, maybe that doesn't just apply to this season, but also their careers, in that Mount went for so much football early on, went on loan, whereas Foden didn't, and has only had kind of this blast of football in the last year, basically changing a lot of the discussion about them. Again, yeah, I think the schedule is an issue. I think Mount's last real kind of energetic performance, that way we really associate him, was the Champions League semi-final second leg against Real Madrid when he got the clinching goal. In saying that, with Chelsea as a whole so far, it's still only about those kind of those three games. And there was a significant drop off against Leicester in the cup final, and I was at Villa Park on Sunday, and they were mostly just fairly unconvincing. They did dominate the game and have a lot of chances. Mount missed probably one of their biggest chances when it was nil all, blazing it over. But in between that, they had been excellent against Leicester in the league. So maybe it's still maybe a little short to read into. And who knows, well, the week of break with this game, where suddenly, that's been very rare this season, where teams don't have a midweek game, and particularly Chelsea, given the amount of competitions they've been involved in. And maybe that will do them good ahead of Saturday. But certainly, Foden goes in on a much sharper form. But it's been remarkable about these two young players as well. I mean, it's not just either that they're going into this game as, you know, the bright hopes, the bright young hopes that are teams in that way. They're genuinely among the most important players of both clubs. So they've seized their chance and have really taken on that responsibility. And both having kind of suffered doubts in the same way as well. I mean, Foden, obviously, as you discussed, there was that long debate about how he was being used and how Guardiola seemed initially reluctant. With Mount, as good as he was last season, there probably was an expectation two different times this year. One, when they made all those signings in the summer, and two, when Tuchel came in, that he would eventually kind of lose his place. But instead, he's made himself one of Chelsea's most reliable and influential players.
In terms of this season, Daniel, Mount is almost the outlier in terms of academy usage, if I could put it like that, you know, especially following the departure of Frank Lampard. Looks like Tammy Abraham, Callum Hudson-Odoi, Tomori, they're all likely to be sold in the summer. Why is there that basic lack of faith, do you think?
I think we probably need to slightly change our preconceptions about what the academies at Big Six clubs are for. I think if you get a talent like a Mount or a Foden, then they will break through. But aside from that, there is an awful lot of work being put in and an awful lot of hours spent to create players who aren't necessarily going to break into the first team, but will make the club an awful lot of money. You know, the three players you mentioned, Hudson-Odoi, Abraham and Tomori, will probably raise Chelsea £90 million or more this summer, which may well fund the purchase of another superstar to fit the first team model that they believe will create a serious title challenge. And maybe that's how Chelsea look at it. Maybe they think, well, if we sell those players, if we buy a superstar, if it forges a title bid, a serious title bid, then it's done its job. That might sound a little soul-destroying and slightly depressing, particularly for those of us who have written books about academy football, Mike, but that might be the reality now. I would add Reece James to the Mason Mount list. He's been, you know, he's come on leaps and bounds, and Chelsea's academy with James and Mount and Rice have three players who will probably go to the Euros with England this summer. So they'll look on that as a success story. But yeah, I take the point. The pathways are not there because you really do have to be an elite footballer or an elite footballer at 19 to have a chance in those first team squads now.
Yeah, I think that was very pertinently put, Dan, if I might say so. Thomas Tuchel seems to be keen on Declan Rice. Miggs, you know Chelsea quite well. What are the politics of buying back an academy reject?
Well, Chelsea have done it before, of course, with Nemanja Matic. Mm-hmm. Okay, it wasn't the same degree in that he got further into the first team, but they're perfectly willing to sell him and buy him back. And I suppose this is one thing about Chelsea in that regard, in that I mean, they're very much results-based in every sense. There was a feeling, obviously, when Rice was young, that he wasn't up to the standards of his close friend Mason Mount. But now he's very much up to those standards at West Ham United after a brilliant season, after maybe performing a role that Chelsea maybe have some issues with. And I don't think they have any... And, of course, they were perfectly willing to go from last year under Lampard. So I think this is one place where the politics are quite clear with Chelsea. In the end, justifies the means.
Yeah. Speaking of which, on Saturday night, can you define, Dan, please, the areas of the game that you think will prove decisive? And if so, who do you think will come out on top?
Well, I think Chelsea are going to have to counter-attack really, really well. I think not just well, but efficiently, because depending on how City play, they may not get a huge amount of chances to do it. But for all the criticism of Timo Werner, and appropriately so, in front of goal, his movement off the ball has been pretty good in terms of making space for Mason Mount with runs in behind. And if he plays Werner and Havertz and one of Ziyech or Pulisic, then there is potential for that kind of counter-attacking football, which has been the undoing of Manchester City in the Champions League. You know, you particularly think back to the Monaco and the Lyon exits, where they basically had complete control but were just caught by maybe a complacency or just defensive sloppiness. I do think that Chelsea are going to have to score first. I think City's ability to control the game. I know Chelsea came from behind against them in the Premier League reasonably recently, but that was a much changed City team. And I think if Chelsea concede first with the slight doubts about kind of ingrained fatigue, even with a week off before the game, I think it's going to be very hard for them to get back in. But, you know, we've seen that kind of mental frailty in City before. They seem to have kind of got rid of that in the Champions League this season. Miggsy mentioned, you know, Dortmund and PSG in terms of how they responded really well there. But in this kind of game, I think this is maybe the chance we could see it if Chelsea score first. But I do think City will win.
Mm. Do you agree with that, Miggs?
I think it's much more 50. I mean, obviously, as by looking at the league table, City are currently, I mean, the English champions. They're probably the best team in Europe. They're a better side than Chelsea. And obviously, they're just at different stages of development, whereas Guardiola has been with the team for so long. He's virtually onto a second cycle now, and the first year of the cycle has ended with two trophies so far. All going well, they should win. But, you know, as Tuchel said before their FA Cup semi-final, I mean, he basically made this exact point that Chelsea have a long way to go to catch up with City in terms of being able to compete for a title. But in terms of being able to compete with them on any one day, that's different. And of course, we've seen that so far, and that Tuchel's beaten them twice in their two games. So I'd have a fair amount. I think by virtue of that alone, and Tuchel's ability to put up with a game plan, I actually think this is a really 50-50 game. And I think there's also a funny thing with the fact that Chelsea have won twice in a row as well. I mean, there's almost this kind of, maybe it's a kind of naive, almost childlike expectation that because Chelsea have won two in a row, that City are almost due. They won't let it go. They won't allow a 100% record. But that can work both ways as well, in that, especially knowing the sort of manager that Guardiola is and how much he obsesses on things, and also how close his football relationship is with Tuchel. I mean, I've done a piece today on how they're both kind of these super obsessives that define this almost, this new strand of manager. And this is now almost what's coming to dominate the game. With that, you know, scene in this meeting they had in 2014 that everyone talks about. But knowing Guardiola and then knowing his obsession with the Champions League as well, that could play in his mind maybe to just maybe potentially make one of these tweaks that doesn't necessarily serve City as well as it might. And for some time, I have to say, I've had a feeling about Chelsea in this Champions League, basically since Tuchel came in. I have a feeling Chelsea will edge it.
Yeah, I must admit, I've got a similar sort of hunch on it. You know, when you're as good a coach as Tuchel, do you go to two, you know, successive Champions League finals and lose both? I think the odds of that are probably against that. But we shall see.
The last was Hector Cooper.
Okay.
With Valencia.
Okay. I suppose, and also, Daniel, you know, what we're talking the morning after the Europa League final, these big occasions, as I said right at the top of the show, you know, the result is all that matters. Now, when you manage as meekly as Ole Gunnar Solskjaer did, you're going to be judged by the result. He was taken to school by Unai Emery. What happens next?
I think he was almost taken to school by himself, in that he just seemed to kind of fall apart and not really have any answers. I thought that there was a really instructive thing, which was, I think, before extra time, there was a huddle, and Solskjaer was kind of on the edge of this huddle, and Paul Pogba was giving the effectively giving this rousing team talk. And I just, you know, Solskjaer's come in for a lot of criticism. Some of it has probably bordered on overkill, some probably even for me, but there's constantly been this overwhelming feeling that Manchester United is probably the club where he's the most likely to succeed, but Manchester United are far more likely to succeed with a better manager in charge. And at some point, they're going to have to make a decision whether they want this connection with history that they feel can be really special, or whether they want to be serious about winning Champions League titles and Premier League titles, which is what a club of Manchester United should be aiming for, with or without the problems and reservations about the ownership. So I'll be honest, without sounding kind of bold about it, it didn't really teach me anything I didn't already know about Solskjaer. He'd become known as a semi-final manager. Manchester United had a reasonably easy run through the quarters and the semis to the Europa League final. And then we saw the same old issues haunt him.
Yeah, it was a bit of a rabbit in a headlight job, wasn't it? Unless we forget, Migs, over the last sort of 24 hours or so, some big managers have come onto the market. Conte, Zidane, and, you know, reading Jack Pickbrook this morning, possibly Pochettino, maybe even going back to Spurs. Do United actually make up for their perceived error last time and maybe have a go at him?
Can't see United moving. The season will be seen as broadly a success because he has improved the overall points total. He has got them second. You would have to say as well, they are that bit closer to a title challenge, given they finished second and they had won the last at about two games in January. But that is genuine progress. I didn't mean to be snide and saying two games. And yet, at the same time, given all that, or despite all that, it's difficult not to agree with what Paul Scholes said after the game last night, where, you know, they're closer, but in real terms, are they really close? Can anyone really see them challenging City next year? I mean, again, I'm talking, this is the kind of thing where it comes back to with Solskjaer for me, especially we're talking about super obsessives like Guardiola and Tuchel, and then a manager like Solskjaer, where, yes, he does make little tactical influences depending on the situation and depending on certain games, but it's just nowhere near the degree of meticulousness, the degree of preparation, the degree of planning, and the depth of thinking about football that you see in someone who is now undeniably the top end coach in the game, Pep Guardiola. And while that's the case, it always feels like United are going to be, no matter how close they get to City in kind of points terms, but they're always going to be some way off. And added to that, it does feel as well like they have slightly benefited from the disruptions to this season. That's not just in terms of COVID, but also in terms of kind of what's going on at some of the other clubs. Liverpool did have this, you know, almost unprecedented injury crisis. You would expect they would come back very strong, or much stronger next season, especially having ultimately kind of straightened things out and finished third. Chelsea should be much better with an actual summer to prepare under Tuchel. At Tottenham, who knows what's going to happen there? If Antonio Conte goes to Tottenham, or if Mauricio Pochettino comes back, they look very different. And I have to say, I'd be surprised if United kicked on that way. And also, there is a slight danger now that they might have maybe jumped another level with the kind of the psychological effect of a win in the Europa League final. And it's why I think that was actually a really big game for Solskjaer last night. Right, the club might see it as underperformance overall. They'll be happy with the general league performance. But Solskjaer did want a trophy, and even if that's one they would have usually dismissed, it could have been transformative, and I think it was really big. And my hunch would be that they will drop off again. And I mean, I think I've said this in the show many times before, but if I was Manchester United, I would be upgrading on the manager. It's no matter how competently Solskjaer has done, I think he's done a much better job than I expected, I have to say. But ultimately, I don't think he's a top-class coach, and United should be appointing a top-class manager.
It was interesting. I don't know if you noticed, Dan, last night, the ghost of Christmas past, Sir Alex Ferguson, waited for David De Gea after the medal ceremony and walk down the tunnel with him. You know, there's a manager, obviously, of huge and enduring authority, which you can't say that Solskjaer radiates. A lot of the inquest has focused on the failure of big players, or perceived failure of it. Bruno Fernandes, Marcus Rashford, both probably who looked shadows of their usual selves. Instead of focusing on individuals, should we be looking at United as a collective? Because that was the one thing that came across really strongly from Villarreal's victory, was that it was a group effort, wasn't it?
It was, and that's been the kind of stereotype of Manchester United this season, even at their best, is that they become a kind of bellwether team on the basis of the performance of certain key individuals, none more so than Bruno Fernandes and Harry Maguire in defence and attack. If Fernandes fires, if he produces a piece of individual magic for, say, Edinson Cavani, then Manchester United are successful. That doesn't completely denigrate everything Solskjaer's done, because he's created a system in which Bruno Fernandes effectively has a free role. But when it gets undone by a side with far lower resources, with a team that contains several Premier League effective failures in Juan Foyth and Francis Coquelin, questions should be asked. You just don't see any, Miggs is right in that there have been some times where Solskjaer has made tactical tweaks that have been successful, but that's not how seasons are defined, as Solskjaer should well know. They're defined by your performance in big games, and Manchester United, other than in their games against Manchester City, slightly ironically, have generally fallen short against the bigger teams and been found out. And yeah, I mean, it's well below par. And I think the real danger for Manchester United, if they don't act soon, is that there's a kind of general decline in reasonable expectation, where suddenly you go into a season thinking, well, if we finish in the top four, that's a success story, which Manchester United fans used to sing and dance about Arsenal doing exactly that. And yet they're in danger of falling into the same boat, I think.
Well, isn't that it as well? Like what Dan mentioned there, basically, that there's this issue now where United could have been going into next season on a real wave had Solskjaer won last, or sorry, United won last night. And again, they wouldn't have gone into the season wanting the Europa League, but that's the effect of a trophy and potentially a first trophy. Whereas now it suddenly, it just feels like the whole atmosphere has changed again, and he will be going in, maybe not pressure from within the club, but from outside. And we have seen that has affected United before, especially given they feel like such a wave team where when things are going well, they can actually look really, really good. Whereas when things are not quite right or they're off form, they can look really unconvincing and really average a team. That's, in fact, alternating between those spells has been almost kind of one of the most identifying hallmarks of Solskjaer's time with the club. And now we go into next season with just that element of, not negativity so much, but just that he hasn't had the boost that he could have, that there isn't the same trophy-winning atmosphere around the team. And I do think it's why Wednesday night was important for all sorts of reasons. Essentially, United had a lot to lose in that regard, and in losing the game.
Yeah, they certainly did. And I suppose it does point out the fact that when we talk about Solskjaer, we talk about a manager who is always going to be one bad result away from a crisis. You know, the sort of thing that you spoke about there, Miggs. I just want to turn it on its head, because I didn't think it was a very good game, if I'm honest, but as an occasion, I thought it was really uplifting at the end, where you have a club like Villarreal from a town of 50,000. You've got players there who've come up through their academy. You only had to look at their fans afterwards last night to realise how much that meant to them. And it reminded me that Super League clubs, or owners of Super League clubs, are contemptuous of clubs like Villarreal. So, Dan, in a way, did the right team win?
Well, the better team won. I mean, Manchester United were dominant, but they were still basically trying to rely upon an individual producing something, and Bruno Fernandes didn't. Marcus Rashford certainly didn't. I think Manchester United probably deserved to win the game on the balance of play, but that's not good enough when you have the resources of a Manchester United versus the resources of a Villarreal. And yeah, it was, you know, other than for Manchester United fans, it was incredibly heartwarming to see, because this has been a season in which those Super League fan plans were firstly met with righteous anger and then were made to look really foolish indeed by the, you know, the failure of Real Madrid and Barcelona and Paris Saint-Germain and Juventus to win their domestic leagues. And this is another, you know, kind of another notch on that bedpost, which is great. Whether it's sustainable is another question, but that only probably means we should enjoy the moment more.
Yeah, you know, we're told, and incidentally, Migs, that UEFA are planning maybe a one-year Champions League ban for Barcelona, Real Madrid and Juventus. Do you think that's likely, or is it going to be real politics taking over? And because you don't have to be a genius to work out that this could end up in the courts.
I think that's exactly where it's headed, especially if they get a season's ban. But I have to say, I do think they're... asked right now, I think they'll get some sort of ban, even if it's just one season. I think there is that will within UEFA. And there is also, I mean, there is the genuine technical and almost legal problem for UEFA that they're still in this competition. And I don't think UEFA can be seen to allow it to stand, especially given the punishment for the nine rebel clubs that left the Super League has been seen as super weak, as someone in the game described it to me yesterday. Another thing to kind of add into this week, I've done a big piece on the politics behind all of this, and also the issue that really shouldn't be underappreciated here, which is that we might well have an institutionalized Super League, not just because of the kind of changes in the Champions League by issues like, you know, the coefficients or the extra games, but because of kind of, you know, the distribution of resources. I think one of the figures going into this kind of potential post-2024 world is that 30% of Champions League prize money will be based on almost European Cup royalties, which is basically that you'll get more money if you've got an existing record in the competition. So it is almost money for turning up. And then, of course, there's all the, you know, there's this deal UEFA are striking, or this proposal, sorry, I should say, where there's going to be a 5 billion fund for so that clubs can take out low interest loans, as well as that there's all sorts of kind of background politics again about the issues like the future of the Club World Cup, which again will just and talk of being almost like a Champions League on tour, and again we'll just see a group of clubs receive money to a far greater degree than anyone else, further affecting this disparity that led to this situation. So I have gone a little bit off track there. but I do think it's worth pointing out. But amid all that, there's so much at play at the moment, and UEFA probably do need to kind of, given the situation with the nine rebel clubs and some of the criticism of the punishments there, I think they need to be seen to be strong here. And again, my hunch would be there will be some sort of ban. Now, it might get fought in the courts. I mean, I think it would probably be inevitable to get fought in the courts. But we could be in for a really messy period in the store. Messier than we've even seen with the Super League.
Yeah, the obvious assumption, Dan, is that if that ban goes ahead, you'll have those teams, those three, replaced by Real Sociedad, Betis and Napoli. You know, I happen to think that would be good for the competition in terms of, you know, its diversity. Do you think that's, you know, would you share that view, that we do need to have a much more diverse Champions League?
Yes, that's the romantic view, which let's broadly put ourselves into. The issue for UEFA is that, well, firstly, they need if they do, you know, impose those sanctions, they need them to be enforceable in court. And secondly, is that they're in this kind of slightly caught between two houses, where they need the Champions League to be successful in terms of, you know, exposure and in terms of revenue globally. And yet they have to be prepared to cut out temporarily three of its potentially biggest clubs to save their own face. So it's a really difficult path for them to tread down, because if they do nothing, they rightly seem weak. If they do everything they can, they kind of risk both making those clubs more determined to force their own change, and B, they rely on them being enforceable in court. So yeah, as Mick says, it's going to get messy one way or another.
Yeah. One good thing, we're told, Migs, that UEFA are going to consider on Friday scrapping the away goals rule entirely. Do you agree that we should do that?
I have to say I waver on it a lot. The away goal does add a real intrigue to games. I think in the last few seasons, it has played a direct part in the scale of some of the brilliant spectacle we've seen in the Champions League, where comebacks that have previously been seen as impossible were suddenly incredible. In saying all that, it is an anachronism. I mean, it was introduced in the 60s when basically, you know, teams would go away to countries from a 1,000 kilometres away or behind the Iron Curtain, or for Iron Curtain teams the other way, where there wasn't that as much scouting available, and the natural instinct away from home were basically to keep it tight and not come out. So it was against that that they were basically encouraged to come out by a rule like the away goal. As we can see from all these comebacks, it's as if kind of home and away, and also because all football is so visible, there isn't the same mystique about going away from home. So they kind of mean the same thing. And there is probably the danger, actually, that for all that it infuses, that the rule infuses kind of a spectacle, it often has the flip side effect where it can mean kind of the gap between sides is so great that can actually serve to kill the tension of a game. And how often have we been in a stadium in a second leg or whatever, an away goal is scored and you can feel that silence and that kind of that anxiety that goes around the stadium, because by virtue of just scoring the away goal, it just feels there's too much to overcome. In short, I don't know where I'm going with you. I don't know what side I agree on, because there are real elements of the goal I like, and they're just such an identifiable feature of European football. But at the same time, there are actual genuine logical arguments for ending with it. I mean, I have to say, the romantic in me just sees it as part of the tapestry in European football, and for that alone, I think it'd be a shame it went.
Ah, well, we're all card-carrying romantics, aren't we? Looking at it a little bit more analytically, Dan, something struck me, and we just hinted at it a couple of minutes ago. Does the relative wealth of the Premier League encourage lazy thinking? You know, I'm thinking here in terms of you've got Lille winning their first Ligue 1 title for 10 years after selling Pepe and Gabriel to Arsenal for 95 million. So in other words, Arsenal have funded Lille's championship. Is that significant?
Yeah, well, it is significant. I don't know if lazy is the right word, because it might well be deliberate. I kind of see it like grocery shopping. If you've got a very low amount of disposable income, you might do meal plans and cook from scratch and look for cheaper ingredients and make do amend with what's in the cupboard. And if you've got lots of disposable income, you walk into a high-end supermarket and buy some ready meals or go out for dinner. And it's kind of similar to that. I'm not sure it's laziness. I think it's just a kind of unique power that comes with having that relative fantastic wealth means that you can allow smaller clubs to develop talent and let's face it, give minutes to those talent at an age where they can develop, where you might not be prepared to, and therefore you pay this kind of super club tax where you know you're going to pay more for those players, but you're happy to do so because you can be more confident that the money you're spending is on a finished product. The issue is when you spend the big money, and you know, the players you mentioned with Arsenal are probably two on which the jury is out. When you spend the fantastic money and it doesn't quite work out, that's when it becomes a problem, I think.
Yeah, I just want to leave this with the listeners. You know, the thought of, you know, Daniel Storey, domestic goddess, trolling up and down the supermarket aisles. I think that was a wonderful image. Anyway, I digress. I apologise. Let's look forward, if we could, Migs, to, you know, the tournament, which, you know, will generate a huge amount of interest over the next month or so, the Euros. With the obvious proviso of further injury, and I would imagine that Gareth Southgate's heart missed a beat when he saw Rashford limping about last night, who do you think are the seven who will miss out from the England squad when it's trimmed down from 33 to 26 next Tuesday?
Well, it was one of the things that struck me when seeing that provisional squad. And it did almost look like, I suppose what Southgate described is basically most of the eventual squad, or maybe up to kind of 26, 28 names. And then a few players bolted on just to kind of allow for the kind of complications that Southgate spoke about with three of his clubs in Europe so late into the season. So some of the names are pretty obvious. I think it'll be one of Ramsdale or Johnston that misses out and go up. Probably Ramsdale, I'd say. I think Godfrey and White will drop out. Then obviously, of course, there's a decision over one of the right backs. Although from how Southgate spoke on Tuesday, and you know the way he went at length about Alexander-Arnold, not least about a potential option in midfield, I wouldn't have the same concerns about Alexander-Arnold there. I think he'll stay. I think Ward-Prowse will probably go. I think Watkins will miss out. and then probably Greenwood and Saka. Yeah, I get with a few of those, there are maybe there's a few knife edge decisions, particularly in the forward positions. But generally, that's how I'd see it.
Mm. Where do you see the right back debate ending up, Dan?
I'm honestly not sure, which is strange this close to a tournament. I don't quite buy into the flack that Southgate has received from some over Trent Alexander-Arnold. It was interesting that he was at pains to say, as Migs refers to, that I've been in constant contact with him over the last couple of months, etc. and so on. I couldn't quite work out whether that was preparing him to be in the squad or kind of preparing him to be left out of it. But the reality is that Southgate has, well, he has a Premier League winning right back in Kyle Walker. He has a La Liga winning right back in Kieran Trippier, both who play pretty well. He has Reece James as a kind of more, he sees as a more complete right back in terms of his defending. And he has Trent Alexander-Arnold, who plays this quite specific role, I suppose, for Liverpool, but that isn't used to the same degree with England. I'd like to see him go because I think he's a phenomenal talent. I think he can probably change a game if we need to bring him on. But when you only get three subs in a major tournament, is one of your attacking substitutions right back for right back? I don't know.
Mm. Because, be honest, Migs, you know, I looked at that squad and I saw just a hint of indecision. Also, when you look at it, we're talking about trimming down to 26. Well, you know, we are used to squads of 23. Within that, does he have any room for manoeuvre within that? Because I'd like to see, you know, let's look at the defence. I still think we're a centre-back short. I think Godfrey in particular has got something about him and may well train on, as it were, in international football. Why not pick a player like that this time around?
I do think there was an element of basically Southgate kind of hedging his bets. I have to say, I'd lean towards a more forgiving view to him. I think he is in a tricky situation with the amount of players out, and I think you're right. There could have been a chance for giving players others a bit more scope. But ultimately, I think it's just about filling. I think he largely knows what his squad is going to be. It's about maybe filling some roles until he can get the full squad together. The one thing that struck me in choosing, particularly from a writing perspective, given I had to analyse it, the way it so quickly went from, okay, we're going to have Southgate's full squad, to then this kind of halfway house provisional squad, which took a lot of kind of energy out of a lot of discussions, with that, of course, now being transferred to next week instead.
Yeah. We've also, those discussions next week, you know, the elephant in the room will be, okay, well, I know this is a pretty diverse tournament in terms of venues, but ultimately semi-finals and finals are going to be at Wembley. So it's football's coming home. You know, a lot more royalties for that particular song going to flood in. Do we overestimate our potential as a footballing nation, especially in these Euros, Dan?
I don't think we overestimate our potential. I think from 2017 onwards, when England's youth teams had that phenomenal, unprecedented year of under-17, 19, under-20 major tournament wins, seven, I think, of those players from that underage summer are already in the first team, and there are others knocking on the door. The potential is definitely there. I think where we lack is, I think Southgate is a decent bloke, and I think he's a decent coach, but I don't think he's a truly elite coach yet, and he might not even describe himself as that yet. So I think we probably lack there, and we lack in that kind of tournament know-how that even with the joy of 2018, we never really truly displayed it, except maybe against Sweden in that kind of comfortable quarterfinal, which England were for favourites for anyway. So I think we lack in those areas, but my big issue with this tournament is the last 16 draw, because if England win the group, they will probably play one of France, Germany and Portugal in the last 16, having come through a fairly, in inverted commas, gentle group stage draw. And I just worry about them getting caught a little bit cold in that scenario against a team that will already have played against two really good nations and got through. So that's my big concern. Ideally, I'd like England to finish second in the group on goal difference and get a lovely pathway through a la 2018, but we don't always get what we want, and England are going to have to face up to a pretty tough task in the last 16, I think.
It's been interesting looking at some of the squads, Migs. that French squad terrifies me. What about you?
Yeah, I mean, they're absolutely stacked. The strength and depth of French football right now is remarkable. And it probably ties in, I remember hearing about 2 years ago, I mean, you've covered the issues like this a lot, Mike, as Dan has already mentioned, but where I think Paris is one of the three areas in the world where there's basically the talent production and the amount of kind of professional or semi-professional footballers. It's the greatest proportion up there with Sao Paulo, I think it was, and apparently the other one was also South London. But you know, I think this has been one of the kind of shifts in international football in the past decade that was probably actually precipitated by France and the original cycle in the 90s, where the major Western European nations have almost industrialized youth production. So we first saw it with France, then saw it with Spain, then saw it with Germany. Now see with France again, and England, as Dan has referenced there, are along the same lines. But we've finally seen a situation where all the football money in these countries is translating into proper talent production. And it does just mean right now that the level of footballer France has right through all age groups, and even when we could be talking about their maybe several layers of backup squads, it's so strong. The interesting thing, I suppose, is that there's maybe, for all that quality, there has been a slight gap maybe in creativity. I don't think that really says that about French football. I think it's just one of those things, one of those kind of freakish things that happens from time to time. But what it's done is also maybe inadvertently solve one of the issues that Deschamps had, which was the kind of, I suppose, the ongoing controversy over Karim Benzema. And also maybe a little bit of a lack of creativity in that French team. And at a stroke, it solved both of those. And ultimately, we have a situation now where, on top of all this quality, France have brought in one of the best forwards in Europe.
Yeah, what I find intriguing about French football is Paris Saint-Germain. They seem to be almost out of kilter with the rest in terms of, okay, you know, as you said, Migs, Paris is a huge hotbed of talent. A lot of former or products of the PSG Academy are playing for other clubs really effectively at the moment. You've got, and I'm sort of linking it back a little bit to managers, you've got Maurizio Pochettino, you know, obviously making it known that he's unhappy at PSG and has held talks with Daniel Levy about maybe going back. Now, you know, the club are saying that they've got no intention of allowing him to leave. But there is a disconnect at that club that I can't quite get my head around, Dan. Are you the same?
Yes, but maybe then I also wonder if it's a kind of inevitable when you know, I don't like to use the word plastic because it kind of infers social media tribalism, but there is a degree to which everything has been gold-plated, and there are things within football and the production of those young players in various places is one of them that you can make better with money, but you can't completely manufacture. And I think that's where PSG have fallen short, and it's where Manchester City, we should say, to kind of bring it back to where we started, is where they succeeded, because they didn't just appoint Pep Guardiola because he was the best, they considered him the best coach in the world. They appointed Pep Guardiola because they'd effectively revamped and rebuilt their hierarchy around the appointment of him to make things as easy as possible. And I don't know if PSG have done that by, you know, the coaches that they've let between have been good coaches, but have not necessarily ever been seen as the best coaches in the world at the time, which, given that they consider themselves, you know, their rightful destiny is to be the best and the biggest club in the world, that strikes me as odd.
Yeah. I'd just like, if I could, chaps, to end on a really depressingly tiresome theme, abusive social media. Just want to read, if I could, to preface, you know, a brief debate, two tweets posted by Marcus Rashford following defeat in the Europa League final. The first read, "At least 70 racial slurs on my social accounts counted so far. For those working to make me feel any worse than I already do, good luck trying." It was the second one that really got me. It read, are more outraged that one of the abusers that left a mountain of monkey emojis in my DM is a maths teacher with an open profile. He teaches children and knows that he can freely racially abuse without consequence. That's the point, isn't it, Migs? No consequence.
Yeah, that's completely it. And I suppose this has been the ongoing issue with the social media companies, where there's this free reign that people say what they like. And bar some small examples, we're not seeing any repercussions. And it has probably, what it feels like has happened as well, it's almost created this atmosphere where it's if people almost dare themselves to go as far as they can on social media because there's no restriction. I think there's a very weird mindset in all of that. I mean that goes without saying, given someone's posting racist abuse, but it feels like there's an element of kind of base racism to it. And also something else that social media does in this regard, where it almost brings this out. I mean, to most of us, it's inexplicable. But from a wider perspective as well, I also think it shows the importance. This is why players continue to take the knee. It is essentially to, I know that there's a wider tapestry, but it is essentially to keep awareness of issues precisely like this, and keep a spotlight on the fact this hasn't gone away, and tragically doesn't look like going away for some time.
Yeah, it fills me with despair. What about you, Dan?
Absolutely, of course. It's the fact that players and high profile people of colour chose to stand up and kind of make a deal of this. And let's not forget the courage they took, because they foresaw this happening. You know, they aren't stupid. They knew that there was a chance that it would take either a long time for social media companies to react, or that no reaction or insufficient reaction would come. And therefore, if anything, they were, you know, the saddest thing here is that by taking that stand, all it's seems to do in some sense is fuel those people to think, well, I'm going to continue doing this because I'm clearly getting a reaction. That's the horrible thing, that without the social media companies meeting them even halfway, they're kind of leaving them out to get worse abuse. And that's obviously totally unacceptable.
Should we all just bail out of social media? It's something that I've thought about. You know, I suppose just to sum up, Marcus Rashford has been a beacon of hope throughout a long, difficult and complex season. He's led the fight against childhood poverty. He's inspired many of those kids to read. Yet, principal among his abusers last night was a teacher, an educator. That beggars belief. Online campaigns like BT Sports Draw the Line have identified the problem, but it's still out of control. Social media companies continue to dodge their responsibilities. They merely wait for the PR storm to subside. In my view, we need a raft of high-profile arrests. These people need to be named and shamed. Otherwise, what's the point? We'll be returning to this issue next season, the season after that, and the season after that. What would you do? Please let me know. And in the meantime, thanks to Miguel and Daniel for their insight, and to you for listening to the Football Writers Podcast.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned, We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.